didn't realize you were in the courtroom. You didn't have to wait for me. Welcome. Next matter on for oral argument this morning is in the matter of the welfare of the child of CES and aka CES parent and DJN. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. We ask that you state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of it in the audio recording. And those timing restrictions are indicated in the lectern, which you can raise or lower to your height at your convenience. Counsel for appellant, you have the floor when you're ready.
Good morning. Please the court, counsel. My name is Lucas Dawson, and I represent the appellant NJN in this case. For ease, I'm going to be referring to him as father today. That gets much easier than trying to do the initials. Your Honor, as I see this case today, there are three main issues before the court. Ultimately, appellant is asking for this court to reverse the adjudication order. The three main issues, though, for the court today are that the adjudication order makes several errors that are not supported by evidence, that misapply the law and go against logic and fact. The second point would be that the district court failed to address father's disability and its interplay in the case that's also tied and intertwined with issue number one, as well as that the department did not provide reasonable efforts. Now, as to the statutory bases, there were four statutory bases that the district court found in its adjudication order. I think the most complicated and probably hotly contested would be the finding of abuse and mental injury. So I am going to focus the majority of my argument there, but of course would welcome questions on any of the other issues. Your Honors, what I think is important to keep in mind in reviewing this case is that the allegations that came in as allegations of child maltreatment. All of those allegations were either screened out or investigated and ruled out. Yet those were also the allegations that were then served as part of the basis for the child protection petition, as well as the department's request that the court make the determination that there was abuse in this case.
When you say ruled out, was that the actual finding?
Your Honor, that is the actual finding. That's maybe the term we use in child protection, but ultimately no determination was made. No determination was made as to maltreatment. When, sort of as a little background, when a maltreatment...
That does differ from ruled out.
I guess I would disagree a little bit, only in terms of that when an allegation can be screened out up front from the very beginning, or after an investigation, the determination can be made that there was no maltreatment, and maybe just in common term, we would say it's ruled out. So that's more of our common term usage, I would say, versus maybe the legal definition. And I apologize for any confusion.
No, that's fine.
Your Honor, when the district court, when you look at the court's order, really as you're looking on pages 32 through 33, the main evidence that the district court ultimately relied on in making that determination was the corner house interview that was conducted, as well as the therapist testimony. At other various points, the district court touches on some of the allegations. But in my reviewing of the order, I would say that those are the two main pieces that the district court focuses on. Now, to support its finding and reliance on the corner house interview, one concern that rises that was discussed is that the district court relies on Minnesota Statute 626.556. And as I highlighted in my brief, that statute was repealed in 2020. The department and the respondent is asking this court to simply consider that a clerical error. The problem that I have with that argument is that if I, as a lawyer, were to walk in here and start citing to your honors using 626.556 in support of my argument, respectfully, you'd stop listening to me, and I would not blame you. Your Honor, that statute was changed. It was repealed in 2020. The cases that the department cites to and relies on are actually cases that began prior to the change in the law. So when the court's issuing a footnote that's now citing to 260E, that is that's appropriate, as the case started when it was 626.556. Then further in, the court also relies on In re the Welfare of NF. In NF, we are talking about a child who, according to the finding or the factual information in that case, was paddled 36 times, and yet that was not child maltreatment. And here we're talking about what the corner house interviewer found. What the child said was that his dad hit him in the face one time. Child maltreatment requires more than that, and it's not for the district court to try to fill in the gaps. The child maltreatment requires to determine, and I was concerned by this in the respondent's brief, and that the respondent, when citing to 260E.03, left out that the statute actually says other than by accidental means. And so here, as was acknowledged by the corner house interviewer, there was no information as to what was the context of this one hit. Was it accidental? Was it discipline? We don't have any other information, and that's simply not enough, even under NF, to get to a finding of physical abuse. As to the mental injury, then, the district court relied on the child's therapist. And what I think is interesting here is that when you look at that finding, and I apologize, I did not put the specific, it's on page 33, I believe, of the district court's order. But that what the court found was that the child likely suffered some type of trauma in father's care. That's a likely suffered is speculation, perhaps preponderance of the evidence, but definitely not clear and convincing evidence. The therapist testified, if you look at the therapist's testimony, the therapist testified that the only issue that the child had told the therapist about was that the father had dropped a weight on the child's foot one time. Again, that's also an allegation that was ruled out. So to put it plainly, there was not enough evidence that was offered. The law does not support the finding of abuse. And so, Your Honors, with all due respect, I do believe that the district court abused its discretion when making that determination. The next statutory subdivision was that the child was without proper food, clothing, or shelter. In that paragraph, the district court really relied on father's, what it said, noncompliance with a voluntary case plan. And it used that sort of in a circular manner to now say that it can use that to make the determination. And as I noted in my brief and the respondent commented on, I could not find any published cases that really truly support this. The notion that now a parent who has a voluntary case plan that's not been court ordered can now have that used to make a determination of child protection. It's quite frankly, Your Honor, against logic and reason. The third piece, Your Honor.
You know, the court also indicated that it thought that your client was minimizing the child's mental health issues. Apart from whether or not he was complying or not complying with a voluntary case plan, doesn't that provide some basis for CHIPS?
Your Honor, I understand that it is a low, while I would like to think it's clear and convincing evidence, it's a higher standard than in general. The CHIPS statutes are broad, so I start with that. I understand that. But I would argue that that alone is simply not enough. If maybe a family court issue, that the child needs therapy and should be in therapy, but that alone would not be enough to get us to child protection, especially when you've got two parents who have joint legal custody. And I think father's main concern was also that father had not been involved in any of that process to provide his input and feedback. And I realize we're not here today to argue legal custody, but that would be a very component of legal custody, is to involve both of those parents in that process. Does that answer?
Does the record support that finding, that he was minimizing the child's mental health issues?
Your Honor, I don't believe the record supports that finding, because really what he said is he was not involved, he did not have enough information. I think, if I recall specifically, part of his testimony was also he did not have enough information, and his lack of involvement led him to really question what was accurate and what was appropriate.
Even though there's evidence in the record that the child does suffer from PTSD. I mean, do you dispute that finding?
No, I don't dispute the finding that there's evidence in the record that the child suffers from PTSD. And I think where this case really turned, though, where the important point would be, is that the district court tried to attribute that in some way to father. And I think where the record is lacking is that causal connection. I mean, even if you look at the court's finding, the court says likely suffered some type of trauma in his care. That doesn't necessarily connect him as to how he's now the cause of that, as well as that in and of itself makes it a child protection case.
In paragraph 85, the court says more than just likely. The court says the evidence supports the allegation that child one suffered mental injury, which is akin to physical abuse due to father's actions. And then at the end of that paragraph, there's two sentences again that directly attributes and links the PTSD to father's actions. And so it's more than just the one sentence about likely. There's direct sentences.
I would agree that I am commenting on one sentence. I understand that paragraph is quite lengthy. But the paragraph also talks about the progress that the child has made, and that father's disputing, of course, that he's the cause. And I think keep in mind, when talking to this therapist, whatever that trauma may have been, quite frankly, children can have PTSD from a high-conflict divorce. And I realize that's the reality that, quite frankly, we live in. But to say PTSD is now somehow abuse, I mean, quite frankly, every parent in a high-conflict divorce would then be the cause of it.
So you're saying then that the district court's finding that the mental injury was, and I'm quoting here from the same paragraph, due to father's actions. You're saying we should disregard that finding as what? Clearly erroneous, or what's the basis for our rejecting that finding?
Your Honor, I don't believe it's supported by the evidence, especially when you look at what that therapist testified to, what she testified to. In fact, when I tried to question her on cross-exam, tell me, what trauma? What trauma? She started crying and told me she did not like it when people question whether someone is a victim of abuse. And so even when trying to be pushed, and when I tried to get into whether, in fact, maybe she was biased, I think the record just simply became devoid of whatever she may have been working on in therapy. Again, that's where we get to the one piece, the one concrete piece she could say on cross-examination was that the child had reported my client had dropped a weight on his foot. If that's now the only piece of evidence of trauma that she can get to, that's not enough. And so it's not the record, when you look at what the actual record is, it does not support that finding.
That's not enough for a child to experience, to be diagnosed with PTSD?
I'm not a therapist.
Well, that's what I'm getting at, is that the therapist said, dropped a weight on the child's foot, and the child has PTSD. Well, and so it's if that's both in the evidence and it's weighing credibility, we're stuck with the credibility findings the district court made. And so that diagnosis connected with dropping a weight on a foot, how do we second guess that?
Well, I think, Your Honor, when you actually look at her testimony, she goes through it's more than to actually diagnose PTSD. She has to go through the DSM-5 and what the factors are. And it was more than simply trauma. And what she also acknowledged on the witness stand was that the information that she got in making her diagnosis came solely from mother, and that she never once talked to father to get his input. And when you're looking at a situation now, especially when we're looking at, quite frankly, this is the type of finding that is used in, you know, further ordering that the client is not allowed to see the child. These findings follow people. It's important. It's important to remember the significance of what this can do even for future relationships. And so, but when you get into it, Your Honor, to answer your question, she did go in her testimony in more detail as to what all, there's more than just that, that would ultimately lead to a PTSD diagnosis. And I apologize, I don't remember exactly everything that she said in that moment. The last piece that the district court, the third factor was that the environment was injurious or dangerous. In that part, the district court really talks about the family court conflict. The fourth piece was that the child was out without proper parental care. And in that piece, as we highlighted in our brief, the district court really failed to address whether, in fact, any of its determination or any of its findings were in part based on my client's disabilities. The district court kind of glossed over it. The district court said he was unable to cooperate with his case plan, but failed to identify how that was unrelated to his disability. That's in finding of fact number 108. I apologize, I'm out of time. I can finish on rebuttal.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning to the court and counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Alyssa Lund, joined by co-counsel Britta Nicholson, and together we represent the Department of Health and Human Services. I request that this court affirm the decision of the district court to adjudicate the child as a child in need of protection or services. The district court made explicit credibility findings devoid from error, issued a detailed and thoughtful order supported by the law and robust citations to the record. As such, appellant's claims are thinly veiled efforts to convince this court to reweigh the evidence and disregard the district court's credibility findings. Such efforts should not be entertained, and the decision of the district court ought to be affirmed. While the statute...
So exactly what are the instances of physical abuse? Is it as Ms. Dawson says, just the one, you know, hitting him in the face? Or, well, you tell me.
It's not. In fact, there are several instances in the record, including, one, the appellant hitting the child in the face when appellant was angry, two, appellant dropping a heavy weight on the child's foot when appellant was mad that the child was crying, three, when appellant slammed the child's head against a wall, causing the child deep pain, in addition to several instances of bruises on the child observed after parenting time, allegations from the child and disclosures from the child saying that my father hit me, that I am scared of my father, and that he hits me when he's angry.
Now, these three instances you're referring to, they were part and parcel of this CHIPS case, not, as Ms. Dawson seems to suggest, part of prior ones where there was no finding of maltreatment. Is that a fair statement, Ms. Lund?
That is a fair statement. In addition to that, appellant does simplify the district court's findings to disclosures through mother, which simply is not true. While the district court did find that mother's testimony was credible in outlining the child's fear surrounding the father, the district court heavily relies on statements and behaviors directly from the child himself. The district court also relies on statements from the child protection investigator, again, a witness who testified credibly to the fact that the child told her specifically that my father threw me against a wall and I almost cracked my head open when he was mad. Particularly, there is a causal connection between the physical abuse and the child's mental injury. And of course, mental injury means, pursuant to Minnesota Statute 260E03, an injury to the psychological capacity or emotional stability of the child as evidenced by an observable or substantial impairment in the child's ability to function. Particularly, the child has exhibited symptoms of reflux, vomiting, shaking, nightmares, tremors, in association with this incredibly congruent PTSD diagnosis as diagnosed by the therapist. But namely, the therapist is not the only witness who testified to the mental injury. In addition, mother, in addition, the investigator, the ongoing child protection social worker, and the guardian ad litem testified credibly to the fact that the child suffered mental injury. Notably, this court need only affirm the district court's determination on one statutory ground. While all four pass a sufficiency finding, I would note that particularly subdivision 6 paren 3 is abundantly supported by the evidence of appellant's unwillingness to provide the child with care and appellant's minimization of the child's PTSD diagnosis. Appellant failed to pursue psychotherapy, failed to submit to a mental health assessment, failed to repair the parent-child relationship by engaging in even one virtual or one in-person visitation with the child. Despite being given ample opportunities to do so week by week and month by month by the child protection social worker, father simply failed to engage to ameliorate the concerns, which led to the breakdown in the parent-child relationship.
Was that a voluntary case plan?
It was.
Okay, and so how do you respond to appellant's counsel's argument about using a voluntary case plan versus a court-mandated plan?
Well, it's true that two unpublished decisions do guide that noncompliance with a voluntary case plan can certainly be considered for purposes of CHIPS adjudications, namely JRW and JLG. The court need also determine whether the child is presently at risk. These two decisions, in addition to the DLD decision, have guided that in making that determination, it's important for the trial court to consider whether or not a parent has attempted to ameliorate concerns which brought a case into the child protection system. So engagement in and compliance with a non-voluntary or a voluntary case plan can certainly be considered in this inquiry, given that the trial court was tasked with determining whether this child was presently at risk of harm. Further, appellant's physical conduct, which led to the child's mental injury, is evident by, again, the child's disclosures, not just mother's disclosures. Either a finding of mental injury or physical injury is, of course, sufficient for adjudication under the statutory ground. The order outlines in immense detail at point 85 the mental injury sustained by the child. The record itself is uncontradicted that the child does not wish to see his father. The child reported being scared that his father was going to come find him. The child resented his mother and resented the investigator for ever sending the child back to his father. The record contains evidence of the child continuously shutting down, regressing, and returning from appellant's house exhibiting aggressive and deregulatory behaviors. In December 2023 specifically, again, the investigator was told by the child himself, not the therapist, not the mother, that his father almost cracked his head open against a wall and that he does not feel safe at dad's. This particularly is a causal connection. Contrary to what appellant asserts today, this is the direct link. Of course, the department need prove that this is not an accidental hit. The department, of course, agrees that that is an inquiry at the trial court level. However, the child is unequivocal that my dad hit me because he was mad. The investigator directly addresses this in the interview, and the trial court found that specifically the physical conduct was the father's actions which led to the mental injury of the child. Further, the child's stark behavior shifts, noted by the credible testimony of the investigator and the therapist, exemplify the effect of father's conduct on the child. In previous interviews with the child at mother's home, he's described as a smiley, articulate, bright young boy. In contrast, when asked about his father, he becomes aggressive, deregulatory, has thrown things in the provider's office, and has similarly regressed to the point of vomiting or getting physically sick. I also want to note that appellant utilizes NF to advance their argument that since the district court's finding is erroneous, in this case, based on the fact that the paddling in NF was insufficient to sustain a mental injury finding. This record in this case is simply not comparable to the record in NF, particularly because, as the court stated in NF, there is simply no evidence to show that the child sustained mental injury. Compare that information to the record in this case, where the child is getting physically sick and, of course, has sustained an incredibly congruent textbook diagnosis for PTSD.
And there's spanking by itself is not necessarily an abuse in Minnesota.
That is accurate.
Can you address the constitutional argument?
Certainly. I think primarily this argument was not raised below.
I saw that in your brief, and that's what I think the argument is, and you can address it directly. I think the appellant's argument is that the district court failed to address a dispositive issue that was raised to the district court. And your argument on appeal in response is that, well, the due process argument wasn't raised in the district court. But the due process argument couldn't have been raised in the district court if the due process argument is that the substantive argument that was raised in the district court wasn't addressed by the district court. Correct me if I'm wrong.
And I'd respond that certainly that issue was addressed by the district court. Appellant's argument forces the panel to ignore pages 36 and page 37 of the order, in which the court states, quote, "The court's focus is again not on the father's disability. The court focuses on father's actions and their impact on child." Further, the court clarified that while father is open with the fact that he suffers from, namely, bipolar and ADHD, and self-reports taking medication to that effect, the court made clear in both two separate findings that father's mental disabilities are not a reason to hold a child out as a child in need of protection or services. In this case, the court expressly stated and disposed of the argument that they were considering father's disability and hinging their statutory bases on father's disability in this case.
Do you agree that there was no waiver of the due process argument?
I would agree that there was no waiver of the argument that father's disability was the cause of the statutory basis. Again, I want to note that the physical abuse in this case was certainly not the only reason that the district court made their findings. The district court based their findings additionally on the conflict between the parents, the child's fear of his father, regardless of the origin of that fear, and appellant's lack of insight into his own anger management issues, which all support a finding that the child's environment is hazardous and injurious, and that father is unable and unwilling to parent the child. The district court certainly did not err in finding that the child's home environment with appellant is injurious or dangerous, and therefore the district court certainly did not abuse its discretion on the following two statutory grounds under subdivision 6 paren 8 and subdivision 6 paren 9. Further, Your Honors, I do want to note that appellant's behavior between the CHIPS petition and the CHIPS trial itself certainly did reveal new or additional concerns about his inability and unwillingness to provide care for the child. Appellant raises the issue of one investigator's determination in that the child did not suffer physical abuse during one subset of an interview with the child. Of course, the department in bringing a child protection case is certainly not bound by one investigator's determination in regards to one investigation. The finding that was made in which it did not support a maltreatment determination was namely made in September 2023. The last date in this trial was in September 2024. A whole year of evidence, including testimony from multiple live witnesses, over 100 exhibits received by the court, identify that certainly the child has suffered and endured trauma beyond the fact that would have been visible at the time that the investigator was observing the child in September 2023. Further, RTB makes clear that, of course, the trial court can accept all or parts of a credible witness's testimony. And so the district court was not bound by one investigator determining at one point in the case that there was not a sufficient finding to support a preponderance of evidence in this case. Again, I want to touch on the fact that, of course, the department has the burden to prove that the child's injury was not caused by an accident. But I also want to note that appellant asserts that this is mere speculation or that there's no causal connection between the physical conduct and the child's mental injury. This is simply not true. While the definition requires that the department prove that it didn't occur by accidental means, the court can also draw a reasonable inference as to how that conduct or what conduct caused the mental injury. In other words, the department need not prove the specific blow or the specific strike which caused the mental injury itself. While we can delineate certainly the conduct and pattern of concerning conduct which was inflicted abuse on the child, the department is not bound to picking one of those allegations to sustain a finding of physical abuse. In this case, the severity of the child's mental injury cannot be reasonably explained by appellant's theory of accidental physical conduct. In addition, the child told the investigator again that appellant intentionally inflicted physical discipline upon hitting him. In the child's own words, the child was crying. If the child would not stop crying, he told the investigator that my father would drop a weight on my foot, and the father in fact did. Thus, there is sufficient evidence to sustain a physical abuse finding, even if the hit, as described at Corner House, was not the specific blow or the strike which causes the injury itself. Of course, both parties agree that the paramount consideration in all juvenile protection proceedings is, of course, the health, the safety, and the best interests of the child. Of course, that supports the district court's findings. The district court's findings were well supported by the record, and the record before the court delineates a need for the amelioration of the safety concerns evident by the child's adverse behaviors and the deep wish not to see his father. Therefore, I respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the district court, given the comprehensive order, that they appropriately applied the case law and tactfully assessed credibility in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
If I could, I want to touch on the very first question that Judge Connolly asked the department about the physical abuse. I would point the court to the finding of fact 84, where the district court specifically found that it need not address each allegation of abuse, as the court finds Child 1's October 5th, 2023 Corner House interview where he said father hit him is credible. The district court specifically did not address the other allegations of abuse and is highlighted within both respondents' closing argument as well as the district court's findings. The other allegations had been ruled out, and specifically as to the one-time hit, within the trial court exhibits, Exhibit 8, there is a note that there is not a preponderance of evidence to support a maltreatment finding of physical abuse. During a Corner House interview, Child 1 stated that his dad hit him in the head one time. The argument I just heard, the statement kept being made that he would do this when angry. That's not what the child actually says. When you look at the district court's findings, under paragraph 37, the district court takes an excerpt from what the child said. And what he said was that his dad hit him one time on the head. When the interviewer tries to expand on that and says, tell me everything about your dad hitting you in the face, Child 1 responded, I don't know what you're talking about. At no point during that interview does Child 1 say that he did this when he was angry, that this was any sort of discipline. Again, there's simply not enough evidence. When the department was asking this court to look at some of the other allegations, the hitting in the face, the carrying of the rocks, if you look at the actual district court's findings as well as the evidence in this case, those were ruled out. So it's not a question of do they now apply in this case. The point is the underlying allegations within the petition were investigated and were determined by a preponderance of the evidence to not be abuse. The last point I did want to at least touch on briefly was the lack of reasonable efforts. Here we're looking at a case. Case plans are important. This court has determined that case plans, it's a creature of statute. They're meant to be followed. They're meant to be outlined to parents. That is how a parent knows what they have to do to get their child back. They are important. Here, we're talking about a case plan that a worker, when she testified, could not recall if she'd actually ever sent it to the client. She could not recall how much she'd explained to him. She said she'd identified the tasks to him, but a case plan requires more.
A case plan requires an explanation to parents of what led to the removal. What are the concerns? What are the strengths? What are the weaknesses? It's supposed to be a joint cooperation, and when we've got a social worker who outright refuses to go to the client's home, to go to the parent's home, to actually meet with the parent in person and see their home, that's just simply not reasonable efforts, especially with a child in out-of-home placement. When the social worker testified, let me back up here. Reasonable efforts have to go to real, genuine assistance. And when you've got a worker testifying that she does not believe that a parent actually understands what is expected of them, let alone even understands why they're in child protection court, that worker needs, that's her job, that's her obligation to go and provide those reasonable efforts to make sure that the parent actually does understand. And so in this case, I would argue that reasonable efforts were not provided. And so for all the reasons stated previously, unless there's no further questions, I would ask the court to reverse.
There do not appear to be any further questions. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Dawson. Ms. Lund, very, very well briefed, very well argued. We appreciate your thoroughness in apprising us of the issues and presenting the case for, on behalf of your client.
Yes, well, and if I can follow up on Judge Ross's point, for both of you, I've been here 17 years. This was one of the finest oral arguments I have ever listened to by both of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and have a great afternoon. We'll issue the opinion within the statutory period. The matter is submitted. Thank you.